Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Brain Trust, Conversations in Psychopharmacology. I'm Dr. Joe Goldberg. I'm a clinical professor of psychiatry at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. It's a pleasure to welcome you to our ongoing series where we have an opportunity to chat informally with colleagues in our field in clinical psychopharmacology on topics that hopefully are front of mind, or at least should be front of mind, in understanding best practices, some of the historical context of clinical psychopharmacology as we now practice it. And today we have a treat for you in terms of our guest. I want to welcome a longtime friend and colleague, Dr. David Dunner. Dr. Dunner is currently director of the Center for Anxiety and Depression in Mercer Island, Washington, and professor emeritus at the University of Washington in Seattle. For those who may not know, Dr. Dunner has been one of the pioneers in our field in mood disorders psychopharmacology, really going back to the early days at Wash U, where he was in training, and at NIMH, and then at Columbia. Dr. Dunner was the originator of some of the language that's now a component of our nosology and our nomenclature, terms like rapid cycling or bipolar 2 disorder. He's also been very integrally involved in the development and clinical trials of almost every drug you can think of in mood disorder psychopharmacology. So with that, David, welcome to our show today.
Thank you, Joe. Good to be here.
It's good to see you again. It's been a long time. So I'm going to start by taking everybody back in time. So this paper, I don't know if you can see this. This is from the Archives of General Psychiatry in 1974. You bet you recognize this paper, David, that you wrote with Ron Feevey, which was Clinical Factors in Lithium Carbonate Prophylaxis Failure. And this 1974 seminal paper was really where the terminology of rapid cycling came from you. Can you tell us how that evolved and came about? Where'd that come from?
Well, the little bit middle length story is that I did a chart review when I was a resident. George Winokur, who was one of the professors there, asked me to review the charts of patients at Renard Hospital to see if lithium was effective for the treatment of, ECT was effective for the treatment of mania. And I reviewed a bunch of records of patients. This is pre-lithium days, and found that yes, indeed, ECT worked for mania, but it was too complicated to figure out how to analyze the data. But that was my first review of charts. When I got to NIMH, I worked with Biff Bunny and Fred Goodwin and Elliot Gershon, who was a clinical associate there with me. The first thing I did was I reviewed the charts of patients who'd been admitted to the NIMH Psychiatry Clinical Center who had mood disorders, and that's where we discovered this group that didn't fit. They had hypomania rather than mania, and they had depression, and we call them bipolar 2, but they were very suicidal and had family histories of suicide. Bipolar 2 has stuck in the nomenclature since. Biff Bunny was very interested in looking at biological factors in patients with bipolar disorder. He was particularly studying steroid excretion in the urine and was very involved in getting patients who were 24-hour cyclers. So he'd go out and advertise around the country for people who had 24 hours of depression and 24 hours of mania or hypomania. And he'd ask that those patients be sent to his clinical unit at NIH for studies. And it turned out that when they were sent there, they stopped cycling. It may have been time zone changes, which we didn't appreciate at the time, but it was very difficult to get a population who had 24-hour cyclers. When I left NIMH, I got a job working at Columbia, New York State Psychiatric Institute for Ron Feevey. Ron was an expert in lithium, and his thing was getting lithium to be used. And it was clear to me as a very junior person working for a very senior person that lithium was his turf, and I needed to carve out something of my own. And so I looked at the other side, not who got better on lithium or its success, but who didn't work, where lithium didn't work, lithium failures. And so I reviewed charts again of patients who were at Columbia University, New York State Psychiatric Institute, actually what was called the Lithium Clinic
yes.
that Ron ran, and reviewed records of patients over several years to find out who got better on lithium, but more important, who didn't, and what clinical factors might be associated with their not getting better. And we had a whole bunch of things, the usual age, sex, diagnosis, bipolar 1-2, unipolar, and found that patients with rapid cycling, people who had multiple episodes over a short period of time, were really patients who didn't do well on lithium and continued not to do well for a couple of years. And we determined that it was 4 episodes a year. Now, there's a difference between an episode and a cycle. We use the term episodes, but probably should have used the term cycle. A high and a low is a cycle. A high and a low and a high and a low are 4 episodes. So 2 cycles or 4 episodes mm-hmm. would constitute rapid cycling. It turns out that I wasn't the first to describe it. I just got famous because of it. Harvey Stancer, who was in Toronto, I think in Canada somewhere, I think Toronto, had actually published something similar from his cohort of bipolar patients, but I get all the credit for it. And it turns out it held up over time. The group at Penn with Peter Wybrow and Mark Bauer replicated that. Mark was on the DSM for mood disorders work group, and his task was to do some research to make sure that it was 4 episodes a year, which they replicated as being important for the diagnosis of rapid cycling. So it got into DSM-4 to define it. And it's still a valid description of patients who don't do well on lithium, but they don't do well on much other things. And lithium is probably their best treatment choice for them.
Now, if I could ask to pin you down a bit more, how are we defining an episode? As the nosology has evolved and people have looked at components that range from mood to sleep-wake cycle to attention processing, thought language, you know, really all the components of the Young Mania Rating Scale that are above and beyond mood. And there's been some research that's talked about activity and energy as being kind of sine qua non features of mania. I'm curious now and back then, how do you say this is an episode as opposed to just a kind of a vicissitude of an ongoing process?
Well, there's something called the Feigner criteria, F-E-I-G-H-N-E-R, mm-hmm. which was the criteria for diagnosis that we used at Washington University in St. Louis. And those criteria required a depression to last 4 weeks or longer. DSM-3 changed that to 2 weeks. That was a committee decision. Mm-hmm. So the duration of an episode was sort of set by a committee. The duration of hypomania is a bit more complicated. When I was at Washington U as a resident, someone asked me to interview a group of medical students, women medical students, to look at premenstrual depression. And so I used something called the Renard Standard Interview, which is sort of like a skid or a mini interview. And part of that was to ask about hypomanic symptoms, which I did. And I found out that the majority of these women medical students described 1 to 2 days of hypomanic symptoms premenstrually, which was sort of interesting. And I think it got lost, but the 1 or 2 days stuck with me, so that when I went to NIMH and reviewed the records there to that ultimately led to the classification of bipolar 1 and bipolar 2, I required 3 days or more of hypomanic symptoms to define an episode. For DSM-4, they wanted to restrict the diagnosis of bipolar disorders because apparently they didn't want a lot of people treated with lithium. That's what I was told.
Really?
And so they made it 4 days or longer in an episode that had to be noted by others. So the criteria I used in New York were 3 days or longer of hypomania for an episode of hypomania, or longer for or hospitalization for a manic episode, or 2 weeks or longer for, well, actually at that time it's probably 4 weeks or longer for depression.
Yeah.
Now there are some patients who have, interestingly, within a day cycling, hour by hour cycling. And when I was at the lithium clinic in New York, we encountered a bunch of those patients, and a lot of them would come in and say, I've got manic depressive illness, because the term bipolar disorder wasn't really in vogue till later. And I have highs. How long do the highs last? 2 minutes. How long do the lows last? 4 minutes. So we saw a lot of patients like that. And it turned out that they had a big substance abuse history. Mm. And there are other people who have looked at what got called ultra rapid cycling, very fast cycling. And it turns out that it has frontal lobe implications in some patients. So frontal lobe damage can cause this. Multiple sclerosis can cause this. A history of substance abuse can cause this. I picked up a number of patients with multiple sclerosis over the years who presented with within a day or sometimes within an hour cycling. So I've learned that very fast cycling is more of a neurological condition than a psychiatric condition. That rapid cycling is actually somewhat slow. It's 4 episodes a year as minimum, but most of the patients have 4. And when you get up to 6 or 8 cycles a year, that's unusual. So it turns out that the cycling is somewhat slower. Actually, in non-rapid cycling bipolar disorder, the episode frequency is about 4 episodes in 10 years. And this, interestingly enough, the 4 episodes in 1 year is a tenfold increase. I don't know what that means. I like numbers, and I don't know what that tenfold increase means, but it's just an interesting phenomenon. So there's rapid cycling, and there's ultra rapid cycling, which probably isn't part of bipolar disorder, maybe some sort of brain disorder or substance abuse that's resulted in that. There had been some work in the in Europe in particular that looked at 2 days of hypomania as being the minimum criteria, and that never really caught on in the U.S. I don't think. There's some data from Europe that suggests that those people might have true bipolar disorder, but I think that 4 days is just fine. Most people that we see who have rapid cycling have 4 or more episodes, with the episodes being at least 4 days, usually longer.
Could I ask how you think about terminology like mood lability or affective instability or emotional dysregulation, which some would say is a transdiagnostic phenomenon? You can see it in PTSD, you can see it in borderline personality disorder, you can see it in substance use disorders, et cetera. You know, it's about as specific as sneezing or coughing in a way. And we don't want to label every non-specific symptom as a pathognomonic syndrome. So can you speak to that notion about just variability as opposed to episodicity, if that's a word?
Well, there's cyclothymic disorder, which cuts into that, which is a form of bipolar disorder with brief highs and brief lows, but not like this ultra rapid cycling business, because those patients often have an episode of depression somewhere along the line, or an episode of longer hypomania somewhere along the line. So it can be seen in relatives to bipolar patients, sort of quick alternating moods. But it's more commonly, I think, found in bipolar II disorder, that people who recover from an episode or a cycle of hypomania and depression which meets diagnostic criteria, will go on to be somewhat cyclothymic, to have brief highs and lows, which is different than what I was talking about with the MS people who get tearful and then elated within 2 minutes, really rapid mood shifts.
Like a pseudo-bulbar affect almost.
Right. And we didn't have that term then, but that's what we would call it now. And
so what would you say to a colleague who's identifying a lot of mood variability, but not particularly changes in cognition or speech language processing or motor activity or circadian rhythms? That is to say, the mood piece without the rest of the constellation that we think of with an episode. How would you help them think about that?
Well, is it psychosocially disabling? Because to have a disorder, it has to have some psychosocial disability. Mm-hmm. You don't have it with hypomania. It's one of the few disorders in DSM where you don't have any psychosocial disability, but certainly the depression component does.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
So people can have, you know, when the team wins, you feel good. Seahawks won Super Bowl and everybody feels great. And the hockey victory, everybody feels great. Some people feel great, at least down south of the border, the Canadian border. But, you know, and if some adverse event occurs, you can feel sad, but not necessarily have a disorder. So it would be a normal reaction to life events that people have. Some people it's accentuated a bit, and some people don't have this very much. They're kind of bland in response to life events. But I think that's just normal mood variation.
So when people, let's go into the realm just for a moment around borderline personality disorder, and people like Marsha Linehan out in your neck of the woods talk about the idea of like having an emotional sunburn. You're exquisitely reactive to interpersonal or other kinds of stressors that have exaggerated emotional responses. But in my view, unlike bipolar disorder, it doesn't particularly impinge on your sleep-wake cycle. It doesn't speed up your rate of thinking, your rate of activity and engagement with the environment. The loss of insight and impulse control, and the time frame can be so compressed that it's hard to talk about episodes. Do you think that that's a fair differentiation in terms of the differential diagnosis of emotional variability or instability?
Yeah, I very much agree with you regarding borderline, and I think it's one of those terms that I think is somewhat overused. I think there are a number of patients with bipolar 2 disorder, in particular, some with bipolar 1 disorder, who meet criteria for borderline personality disorder because they do things when they're high or low that would just meet the criteria for it. I think that's part of having a bipolar disorder, because I think, as you said, the episodes in borderline personality disorder tend to be briefer. The mood shifts tend to be quicker. When I was at Columbia, New York State Psychiatric Institute, Otto Kernberg was there, and we overlapped for a bit. Mm-hmm. And I was brash enough to approach Otto and suggest we do a research study where patients that his group had diagnosed as having borderline personality disorder would be put on lithium or placebo and then reassessed after 6 or 8 months to determine if the borderline personality disorder went away. Because I was convinced that a lot of patients that he was diagnosing as borderline actually had bipolar disorder. We never actually got that study off the ground. Someone once told me that they were amazed that Otto would actually consider a psychopharm study, but as a participant. But I've seen a number of patients who have borderline personality disorder and bipolar disorder. So I think they can coexist. That gets life a little complicated. Lithium, I think, helps that, helps both aspects of it. but they still may have their borderline personality disorder in spite of lithium treatment. It doesn't go all the way to normalize those moods. But I think a number of patients who get called borderline just really have a bipolar disorder.
So I wonder just about the underappreciation for the non-mood symptoms. And when a patient comes to me and they've been on a lot of things and they're saying, my moods are still varying, I'm always curious about, how's your sleep? How's your energy? What's decision-making like? You know, the concept to my mind, part of what's made in my career studying bipolar disorders so fascinating is almost the non-mood symptoms that we sometimes don't pay as much attention to. Do you think that when we talk about drugs as mood stabilizers, we're over-attending to one component of a broader syndrome? It'd be like calling cardiac meds analgesics when they're treating angina, but they're really doing far more than just addressing one manifestation.
Well, we're treating the syndrome. When we treat bipolar disorder, we're treating a depressive episode. So the depressive episode will consist of a mood change, but also changes in sleep, appetite, energy,
yeah,
concentration, hopelessness, mm-hmm, worthlessness, suicidal thoughts. It's not that we're just trying to get rid of the mood and normalize that. We're trying to normalize as much as we can of this episode. And the same thing with mania or hypomania. Now, one of the problems with mania is that it's a terribly unstable disorder. It's not elated mood. We actually had a patient when I was at NIMH. We did a number of patients who we had medication free, which I don't recommend anybody do, because when a manic is medication free, they require to be put in a seclusion room because they can be dangerous to themselves and others. And in NIMH, they had someone sitting outside the seclusion room. And I remember one patient in particular would have a loud outburst and everybody would come running and go down the hall to his room and he'd be asleep. And he decided to have the person outside of his room monitor his moods every 15 minutes. And we use terms like normal, elated, angry, asleep, depressed. And what was interesting was that all of those mood states would get clicked off within an hour or two. So that people, when they're manic and they're elated or paranoid or grandiose, will also have periods of depression, will have periods of normal mood, will shift somewhat rapidly within mood states. Whereas their depressive phase tend to be more solid. They get wake up depressed and they stay depressed. They don't change very much. You can sometimes light them up if you talk about when they were manic. You can make them get into an artificial high state. I've done that with a lot of patients. But you can't do that well with mania. It tends to oscillate. We pasted all of these ratings on the wall. Elliot Gershon and I are sort of looking at these things, trying to find some sort of cyclicity to it that made sense, and we couldn't. They were quite random, but no, it was rare for two of these to be checked off together consecutively. In other words, there was just an intense lability
to
a manic state. And I think one of the other interesting phenomena, I don't know if you've noticed it, but that grandiose manic patient that we used to see, who we'd come home and tell our spouses, "Do you know what this guy said?" You know, and it was funny. They've almost disappeared. Mania has changed, so it's more irritable and paranoid. And this diagnosis of mixed states has taken over maybe 50% of patients in clinical trials versus maybe 10%. When I started out in the field, it was unusual to find patients with mixed mania or who had predominant irritability. Whereas now that's what we see most of the time in a manic episode.
I share your observation.
I
share your observation, and you, your comments make me marvel at this, because Those of us, I guess, old enough to remember the older phenotype can all think of examples of patients who said or did things that were expansive, big ideas. I mean, I had a patient once before the millennium changed. He had a big idea. He was going to figure out a way to make all the, remember the Y2K problem that we were all afraid the clocks midnight, technology would go sideways, and he figured out some way to hook up all the computers in the world that would prevent that. Then he went out and tried to raise capital, and it was pie in the sky and euphoric and expansive. And it almost sort of put a smile on your face. At the same time, you could recognize there was really no awareness on his part that, I know this sounds a little offbeat. It made all the sense in the world. But yeah, I don't see people like that so often either. When I do, my first thought is lithium. And when I don't see those people, maybe that's part of why we don't think of lithium as often, as we've come to associate lithium with what some have called Cage disease, or the more euphoric predominant rather than dysphoric predominant kind of mania.
Well, I think part of that is lithium is not a commercially sponsored product. It's generic, and it's always been generic. And so nobody's out there promoting it. And although we had lithium clinics back in the 60s, and it was a focus of a lot of medical students, medical schools, departments of psychiatry, those have disappeared as lithium got to be used more by ordinary clinicians. And then along came Depakote, and Depakote was promoted, and carbamazepine, and carbamazepine was promoted. When I moved to Seattle from New York, it turns out that the predominant drug used for bipolar disorder was carbamazepine, because the Ciba-Geigy rep was a very good rep, and really promoted carbamazepine, which at that time was quite off label, but people could do that. But most of the patients with bipolar disorder out here were being treated with carbamazepine. And then along came Depakote, and that was actively promoted, although the clinical trials were surprisingly not as good as outcome as Abbott had hoped for. But certainly took over. And then Oxcarb, because you didn't have to do blood levels, but there's no data to support the use of that drug in bipolar disorder, that became very popular. And then for a while, gabapentin became popular, although we were participants in a study that showed it didn't work. And so other anticonvulsants like Topamax were studied in bipolar disorder, and they didn't work. So not all anticonvulsants worked in bipolar disorder, but a couple did. And I think that psychiatrists just got away from using lithium. I grew up in a lithium clinic. I used to say, I treat one disorder with one pill, and that's kind of what we did. We didn't have many other choices. We had some tricyclics for depression and MEO inhibitors, but it was amazing to see lithium sort of disappear from the teaching. And so a lot of residents who graduated probably in the after the 90s didn't have a lot of experience with lithium, sort of like MEO inhibitors. A lot of graduating residents have heard about MEO inhibitors but have never used one.
Or the idea that you could even subtype the illness based on responsivity. People who talk about lithium responsive bipolar disorder or MAOI responsive major depression for that matter, I think are losing some of the depth of phenotyping of the illness, the same way we can define infectious diseases by antibiotic responsivity. I for one, have always been an advocate of encouraging residents to think about this ailment is or is not responsive to certain kinds of treatments as a way of delineating really what the pathology is, huh?
Well, rapid cyclers don't respond that well to lithium, but they respond probably better to lithium than other drugs, at least in my experience. So lithium is a big part of treating rapid cyclers, and the ones that I've continued to treat, I really give lithium a good try, to see if we could stabilize the mood. Lithium has targets the four major areas you'd like to target for treating bipolar patients: acute mania, acute depression, prevention of mania, and prevention of depression. And there aren't a lot of drugs that do all four. The Lamotrigine will do the depression start phase of it, but not against the highs. The Depakote data suggests that it has some antidepressant effects, and its mood stabilizing effects in the clinical trial that Charlie Bowden was the first author on didn't show it had an effect preventing mania. Lithium did, and the comparator as a comparator in that trial. So I'm sure that Depakote has maintenance effects because I've used it for maintenance effects and with some success, you know, particularly when lithium failed or other things failed. But the data aren't there from the double-blind trial that was conducted.
Well, if I could pick up on what you just said, for our viewers, a finer point here, may have to do, some would say, with acute responsivity as an enrichment criterion. So as you were just saying a moment ago, the Depakote studies failed to show a signal to prevent recurrences in bipolar I patients compared to placebo when they took all comers into that study, regardless of what worked for you acutely. Valproate, Depakote was no better than a placebo. When they went back and looked at, well, did Depakote happen to help you when you were manic? And if so, what got you well is more likely to keep you well. I often assume that it was axiomatic, what gets you well keeps you well. But I always thought that the Depakote story, and one reason why we don't think about it as much for maintenance, not the only, but one reason, is if we don't take into account its acute responsivity before considering its long-term effect, we may sacrifice some of the statistical factors that go into predicting, is this drug going to work for you or not? I would suspect as much is true with antidepressants. If it doesn't work for you acutely, why would we expect it's going to prevent recurrence? Would you say that this notion of enrichment is something that our colleagues out there may not pay as much attention to? Or feel free to disagree with me if you like.
Well, I think it's an interesting concept because we use esketamine nasal spray, and we get fantastic results with esketamine nasal spray for patients who failed 8 or 10 antidepressant treatments. And my thinking about it, without any data to support this, but my thinking is that by taking people who have multiple treatment failures, at least four is where we start, to usually different kinds of antidepressants, antidepressants that are supposed to work differently, that we've washed out all of the patients who were monoaminergic responders, so that we've taken the patients who would respond to a serotonin mechanism or a norepinephrine mechanism or a dopamine mechanism of their depression, because we've given them all the drugs that work on those systems, leaving a pool of patients who have some other mechanism or mechanisms of why they got depressed. And enhancing the pool means that we're getting a huge response in that residual group because we've wiped out all of the SSRI responders, and leaving whatever esketamine does, leaving a high percentage of patients who are apt to respond to the mechanism of that drug. And I think that enriching samples is an interesting concept that is somewhat new to the field.
You did it in reverse. You did it in reverse, the rapid cycling. You said, let's take the lithium non-responders and see what characterizes them. And I think that's out of that work was born rapid cycling. What if someone someday, God knows who or where, is going to take all the esketamine non-responders and say, well, why don't they respond? Is it because they have a non-monoaminergically responsive form of depression? Is it because they're left-handed? Is it because of the phase of the moon? I mean, what is it about the subtype of the patient that could inform us? To me, that's what the enrichment idea speaks to.
I love it. But the problem is nobody has a big mood disorder population anymore to do it. All of those lithium clinics, I mean, I had access to 500 patients, maybe 200 active patients and 500 records of patients to review for when I worked with Ron Fevey. Yep. And, you know, it was it was just, you could do a lot with that data set. Lithium, Ron went on to try to create what he called the lithium library of patients that he'd evaluated, some 5,000 patients, to try to characterize them and make this a kind of living tool for research. I don't know if it ever got completed. I know part of it got put on computers, but nobody has that kind of population anymore. Lithium clinics have disappeared. Most medical centers don't have a mood disorder center anymore. They may have a mood disorder doctor if they're lucky. The clinical expertise at some major medical centers, I know at your medical center, they have several people who are expert in complicated mood disorders. But at some medical centers, they don't. And those people are in the community, but they have 200 patients. Maybe not all of them have mood disorders, but it's not a big enough sample to do anything with, and they're not particularly research focused. So, I mean, the STAR-D study was an attempt to get into a bit of who might respond to what, and it was 3,000 patients, and it kind of didn't work well. The RECOVER study of treatment-resistant depression, it's involving vagus nerve stimulation, is 500 unipolar patients and 500 bipolar patients, which is who are exquisitely treatment resistant, four or more treatment failures in the current episode. But, that's still a relatively small sample, even though it's a big sample. It took 83 sites to get that number of subjects in a clinical trial. So part of this is that whereas severe mood disorders used to be treated in the hospital, and when I was growing up, if you had depression, you got hospitalized for a month and had ECT at WashU in St. Louis. And it wasn't really an outpatient disorder. It was an inpatient disorder because people, by the time they got to anybody's attention, were severely depressed. And you hospitalize them in D.C. When I was at NIMH, people were hospitalized for a year because they weren't using antidepressants very much. They were using psychoanalysis. And when I got to New York, again, with advances in psychopharm, hospitalization rates, at least in our mood disorder clinic, were pretty brief, but not as brief as they are now, because managed care says if you're depressed, you're out of the hospital in a week, which isn't long enough to do anything. Mm-hmm. But I don't think these numbers of subjects are around anymore for anybody to really look at it. There was a study I read recently, I think it was in the archives, looking at a genetic factor in depression treatment. And they found that a group of people identified by a certain genetic factor didn't respond well to antidepressants, but it took like 50,000 patients or something like that to get that sample. There's I think a Australian sample or Danish sample.
Small effect and, sizes, big samples.
Well, yeah, you need, I mean, what we're looking at to try to look at non-responders, look at the FDA data on suicidality, which took over 50,000 patients from clinical trials of antidepressants to find a statistical difference in young adults and teenagers of 2% increasing their suicidal thoughts on placebo and 4% on drug. I mean, nobody has access to that sample size. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a doubling of increase in suicidal thoughts, but it took 50,000 plus patients to show a statistically significant 2% difference. Nobody has those populations anymore, which is probably good for the community because people are getting treated earlier for depression now. And I think we're more effective in treating depression now than before. But trying to do research on depression gets to be more complicated. Who's going to have, let's say, 100 patients who haven't responded to esketamine? I mean, we probably have 20, maybe 20 at our site. And so you either have to pool the data to figure out what's going on, and then you have to be able to characterize those patients uniformly across a bunch of sites so you make any sense about it.
Yeah. And there's little incentive on the part of the industry to want to study when a product is not a good idea to prescribe to somebody. If you're the
right,
manufacturer,
you don't want to study treatment failures, right?
Yeah. It's ever since NIMH pulled out of the business of clinical trials in 2013, we're sort of, for better or worse, relying on what privatization of clinical trials has to teach us. So let me, before we wind down, on a practical level, someone comes to you with well-defined, well-diagnosed unipolar major depression, let's say, had multiple adequate trials that were not effective, not the result of inadequate dosing or poor adherence or comorbidities. We see people like this, I'm sure, in our practices all the time, and there is no one go-to. But in your mind, when you're thinking about what you called exquisitely treatment-resistant patients before, especially for those of our viewers who may be encountering such people and want to not feel like it's trial and error, any words of wisdom to our listeners and our colleagues about how to think about those exquisitely treatment-resistant patients after you've ruled out all the artifactual reasons why they could seem that way in terms of how to think about what to do?
I think what it calls for is what's called neuromodulation, transcranial magnetic stimulation, vagus nerve stimulation, which hopefully will get funded by Medicare, so it will be available by more insurance companies, although I think some insurance companies are starting to fund it, even without Medicare support. I think at your site, deep brain stimulation for the really bad outliers from this. S-ketamine nasal spray, I think, is a good option. So I think we do have things available for these patients where before we didn't. Let me say a couple more things. Cycles. Two episodes of depression a year should suggest as a rapid cycling. And I think the corollary of that is those people most often have a history of hypomania if you detect it. And part of it is detecting it. So you have to be a good clinician to say just before or just after these depressive episodes, did you have an upshoot in your mood? Did you go above the normal mood line? Do your relatives think you have ups or highs to define bipolar II? We actually published a few cases of patients who I think had two or more episodes of unipolar depression in a year, but didn't have hypomania. And there was nothing.
You wrote about unipolar rapid cycling, did you not?
Yes.
High recurrence as opposed to polarity. Fred Goodwin used to talk about this notion of polarity versus just recurrence and high recurrence.
Yeah, but I think most people who have recurrent depression, frequent recurrent depression, have bipolar II disorder or have histories of hypomania. And you just have to know how to ask about it to document it. That's one issue. The other issue is, I think it's one of the few disorders that's actually had some replication to it, so that Mark Bauer, when he did his review for DSM-IV to include rapid cycling in it, actually found that four episodes or more defined the group. Because there was an arbitrary decision. I looked at the records of these patients, and it looked like if you had four episodes, you didn't do well on lithium as much as if you didn't have four episodes. So replicating things in psychiatry, I think, is important because we need to get data that says that this is something that we can count on. And that's now in the literature, and I think we can count on it as being true.
Psilocybin, new data from Compass, as of just of a week or so ago, looks like they're at their primary endpoint. Might be going to the FDA soon. Thoughts there?
Yeah, I grew up in this, and what I saw was long-lasting side effects. So I don't have so much concern about the efficacy of these compounds as much about the long-term side effects of these compounds. And I think the safety issue is more concerning to me, unless they show that this is a long-term safe compound to use.
You think that's for all comers, or I'd be really nervous about, say, a bipolar disorder patient or somebody with a psychosis diathesis or anyone in particular where you'd say yes for you, but not for you.
I don't know that we have the data to make that decision, but I assume
Speculate.
that if these drugs get approved, we'll have that data
Yeah.
pretty quickly. Because we'll have some disasters if it's adverse in some patients.
Right. And the very last thing I want to ask you about before we wind up, which I probably should ask you about before, but second generation antipsychotics have certainly come to the forefront as the really first line treatment for so many phases of mood disorders or in unipolar as augmentations. In just a couple of minutes' time, could you say, I think that that's a good move and reflective of the pharmacodynamic properties of these multi-targeted drugs? Or would you say, marketing, marketing, marketing? And I really think it's the disservice to the field to the exclusion of other treatments than atypical antipsychotics. How do you think about this very fine line I'm describing?
Well, first of all, they work, so that it's clear that they enhance, bring out an antidepressant response in people who haven't responded to typical antidepressant treatment. The there are several remaining questions that I have. For example, if one atypical doesn't augment the antidepressant response, is another going to? And I see patients who failed multiple atypicals, but that's part of the reason they're seeing me is they failed a whole bunch of drugs. So I don't know that's really been answered. And the other one that Janssen tried to answer, but the study was complicated, is how long do you have to continue the atypical once you get a response? And nobody really has that data. I'm not so concerned about metabolic effects and TD in that population because the doses tend to be low. For the most part, the drugs are effective on clinical trials in 6 weeks, but in the early aripiprazole study, it was effective in 3 weeks. With the olanzapine study, it was effective in a week. With the risperidone study, it was effective in a week. So if I don't get results in 3 weeks, I'm going to move on to something else. The other issue is where do you position the atypical in the treatment paradigm of a depressed patient? If you fail an antidepressant, what do you do next? And the usual thing is to give a second antidepressant. And I think it's a bad choice to give a second antidepressant that works similarly
Yeah.
to the first antidepressant. Now, I say that, but I don't believe we know how depression comes about or how drugs work. But we have labels of SSRIs and SNRIs. I don't know that's how the drugs work, but I think it's not good form to go from an SSRI to an SSRI to an SSRI to an SSRI. I think you ought to switch presumed mechanisms. So if the atypicals work so quickly, is it worthwhile to go from an SSRI failure to adding an atypical at that point? And if that doesn't work, then do another antidepressant, let's say an SNRI, and then you've got three treatment failures, and presumably the patient has been treated with psychotherapy too, like cognitive th behavior therapy. And so now you have four treatment failures, which then gets them into the esketamine or TMS range. Now, I know TMS is given after one or two treatment failures, But we think that a treatment that costs several thousand dollars ought to be after a treatment that costs less, like another medication. So we restrict our TMS to patients who, transcranial magnetic stimulation, to patients who failed four or more treatments. And we still get a 50, 60% response rate in that group versus STAR-D, where you would anticipate a 15% response rate.
Yeah, if STAR-D told us anything, I'd say you have two shots at traditional pharmacotherapy for depression. After that, you got to do something else. Whatever the something else is where the field will hopefully take us. But more doing the same thing over and over again, what do they say is the definition of insanity?
Yeah. Getting back to your earlier point about enhanced samples, I think there have been some studies that seem quite logical. So you take patients with anxious depression or retarded psychomotor retarded depression, and you put the anxious depressions on drugs that are preferentially anti-anxiety antidepressants, and you put the psychomotor retarded patients on drugs that are less anxiolytic, and that doesn't work. You know, we're very bad at predicting who's going to respond to what drug. And it's not clear why that should be. I mean, even us, those of us who think of ourselves as really good antidepressant clinicians, can't really decide that first drug with more than 70% or 80% accuracy. I mean, we should be able to say this drug ought to work 95% of the time. We can't do that. And so I'm not sure why. I think that part of the reason is there are many, let's say, biological types of depression. And we've lumped them all in, especially major depression, we've lumped them all into one diagnostic category. But there are probably a whole bunch of ways these people get depressed chemically. And 70% will respond to a drug that works on the serotonin syndrome or serotonin norepinephrine mechanism. But it's clear that we lack a lot of insight into what's the absolute best drug for this patient. We're making an educated guess, but still not. I mean, and we're doing pretty well. I mean, we're doing much better than we did 50 years ago. But I think that we're still having a guess as to what the best first choice antidepressant might be. And it's not clear what we should do second line. And it's not clear what we should do third line, except I think going to a drug that presumably works differently is a good thing to do.
Makes total sense. At the very, I tell my patients, the one thing I can promise you is a rationale.
Right. And a lot of clinicians don't seem to have that. They don't have a plan. That's when I see a patient in consultation, I try to plan out at least 2 to 3 treatments. We're going to try this. And if that doesn't work, we're going to try that. And if that doesn't work, we're going to try this third thing. And if that doesn't work, we'll get together and we'll talk about what the options are.
Yeah. And these are hard to treat illnesses. Not for nothing is, you know, depression the leading cause of disability in the world. What do our oncology colleagues do? They'll take a first pass at something. If it doesn't work, they have a backup plan, third plan, and, you know, recognize the limits of technology alongside the hope for newly emerging technologies.
I'll take issue with you a little bit. I think depression is a lot easier to treat now than it was 30 years ago, 40 years ago. I mean, this is an outpatient disorder. Most patients can continue to work while they're being treated. The hospitalization rate for depression, I think, is way down compared to what it was before. I think we're seeing these patients earlier in the course of their illness. Even patients with recurrent depression, I think we've got good data that maintenance treatment will reduce significant future episodes. So I think we've learned a lot about what to do. And I think we have better medications now than we did before that are better tolerated. You're probably at the end of the tricyclic era, right? I mean, that's what we had when I was growing up. And, you'd use Elavil until patients fainted because you'd raise the dose and raise the dose and raise the dose. And then people get orthostatic hypotension and you have to back down a bit. And, or they'd have other side effects from those drugs. Those are useful drugs, by the way. And I have some patients on tricyclics who haven't responded to what's out there now. Interestingly, and I have some patients on MEO inhibitors because what we have out there isn't useful for them. So there's a whole array of things that we can do now that are different than what we had earlier. And before we had ECT, and I don't use ECT very frequently anymore. I mean, it used to be the go-to treatment in someone who got hospitalized because it would get them out of the hospital quickly. Rarely have to use ECT anymore.
Our palate has expanded. I will completely agree with you on that. And I think we have reduced the morbidity. We haven't quite figured out how to cure the illness or how to get it and keep it in prolonged remission long enough that I think it can be even better prognosis than it was 50 years ago. But yeah, I would not quibble with the notion that there have been advances and more work to do ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me today.
David, I want to thank you. We could go on and on and on. I hope we'll have you back on our program again soon. But it's always informative for me to hear your wisdom and your insights from so lengthy, distinguished a career as yours. You've seen so much, and you really bring to bear a wonderful perspective. So, thank you so much for joining us today. I want to thank our listeners and viewers for joining us. I hope you found this as informative as I have, and we hope to see you back again really soon on Brain Trust: Conversations in Psychopharmacology. Bye for now.
This podcast is presented by Psychiatric Times, the number one psychiatric publication in the U.S. Visit us at psychiatrictimes.com for the latest clinical news, expert perspectives, and CME opportunities. Thank you for listening.